From the Sky News Centre at 5. The nurse arrested in relation to the deaths of patients at Stepping Hill Hospital in Stockport will not face trial. The Crown Prosecution Service has decided it's no longer appropriate to continue the case against Rebecca Layton. The 27-year-old was charged with criminal damage, intending to endanger life following the unexplained deaths. The mother of a teenage girl murdered by a former boyfriend says she'd welcomed the return of capital punishment. Rebecca Aylward was bludgeoned to death by 16-year-old Joshua Davis in Woods near Bridgend. Rebecca's mum, Sonia, says they'll never forgive him.
Just hate him for what he's done to our daughter. He was part of the family, lived with us a lot, didn't he? And he betrayed us all.
A young woman who lured two teenage girls to a house where they were raped has been jailed for 7 years. 19-year-old Stephanie Knight from Rawsonstall pretended she was taking the girls clubbing. Instead, they were attacked by three men who were also jailed. The Red Arrows have given their first public aerobatic display this afternoon following the death of one of their pilots. Flight Lieutenant John Egging died when his aircraft crashed near Bournemouth Airport during a show on August the 20th. Red 10 Squadron leader is Graham Bagnall.
It's been a sad 2 weeks, of course, and without him in the formation, there'll be something missing. However, this is our chance to honour him and pay our respects to him with our flying, and we think he would like us to have gone on to do that, so that's why it's so important for us to keep going.
Air Miles customers will no longer be entitled to free flights under the new terms of the relaunch reward scheme. Those flying outside of Europe will face paying hundreds of pounds in airline taxes, fees and surcharges. And Matthew Rhys has landed the lead role in a major TV adaptation of Charles Dickens' great unfinished work, The Mystery of Edwin Drood. The actor will play John Jasper in the murder mystery. That's the latest. I'm Adam Lindsay.
BCFM 93.2.
Your award-winning radio station.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling. We've got no politician helping us review the news this week. Instead, something which has affected politics for the last 10 years. Yes, it's 9/11. In the run-up to the 9/11 10th anniversary, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and I will devote the first hour to some of the most powerful evidence of a 9/11 cover-up that you haven't yet heard. And it's emerged over the last 10 years. We hear from two eyewitnesses who have gave detailed testimony to the 9/11 Commission of Inquiry. When the final report was published, none of their evidence was in there, so that may be why you haven't heard of it. And after the 6 o'clock news, we're joined by a local historian and also a local businessman to get a health check on our city's economy and the health of our democracy. We'll also be hearing from former TV comedian Mark Thomas, who'll be down at the tobacco factory from Monday to Saturday next week as part of his national tour with the usual biting satire and a new show about rambling in the Israeli-Palestinian war zone. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows 13 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 20, sunny spells on Saturday and some heavy showers, though, on Sunday. So if you've got to get out and about, do that on Saturday. Next week, highs of 20 Celsius, a fairly wet week with some gusty winds. Next weekend, that's the 10th and 11th of September, highs down to 16 Celsius, some sunny spells and also some showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guest. Not guests, just one, and joining us is old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, who's one of the four coordinators of something called the UK Reinvestigate 9/11 campaign. Hi, Martin.
And hello there.
Why reinvestigate the 9/11 attacks?
Well, the original investigation, which of course was basically resisted by the Bush administration, the families of the dead pushed for it and eventually forced an inquiry, but that inquiry, as you've pointed out, did not in fact uncover what had happened, and therefore we feel that there's unfinished business there.
So how has the 9/11 this is the politics show, how has it affected politics over the last decade?
Well, I don't think anybody doubts that it's made a huge difference to what's happened in the world in the last 10 years. I mean, Tony Blair said in the about the invasion of Iraq, that 9/11 had changed the balance of probability, and that although we'd been able to put up with Saddam Hussein for 30 years, he had to go now because even the remotest possibility that he might be involved in terrorism was not acceptable after 9/11. So Tony Blair himself used 9/11 as a justification for the invasion of Iraq, for example. That's just one way in which it's influenced.
So rather than the presumption of innocence in international politics, we now have the presumption of suspicion and potential guilt.
Indeed. I mean, the story that we've been told, this changes the rule book, we can't play by the rules anymore, we're not interested in habeas corpus, we're not interested in the Geneva Convention, that's all gone out the window because of 9/11.
Now, who else is part of this reinvestigate group that you're in?
But the reason why we only have four of us as coordinators is that we don't actually want to spend an awful lot of time arguing about details with people, because there's an awful lot of detail that people want to get into. Our ideal is to approach opinion formers, politicians, journalists, police, military, secret services, and we want to be able to approach those people without messing up our approach by having lots and lots of extraneous discussion with people about details about 9/11. We want to focus on the main facts, and we want to talk to people in authority about them.
So who are you?
There's myself, Martin Summers, Annie Machon, who used to work for MI5, Ian Henschel, who wrote the best British book about 9/11, and Ian Neal, who most people probably won't have heard of, but he's the fourth member of our little group. So, and of course, we've got a wider group around that, but we're the four trustees or coordinators, if you like.
Okay, now one of the main things which is used to debunk people like you is saying, well, we've already had a 9/11 Commission inquiry, but we've also had this National Institute for Science and Technology report, the NIST report, which has concluded that really the official story is true, and all this talk that people like you go on about controlled demolition of buildings on September the 11th is nonsense.
Well, they would say that, wouldn't they, as Mandy Rice Davis so famously put it. The government tells you what they want you to know, and that's what governments do. You can't take them at their word. These structures are not necessarily transparent. The main killer fact for me is Building 7, WTC 7, which some of our listeners may have heard of. A third building collapsed on the day of 9/11 at 5:20 in the afternoon, some hours after the first two buildings. It fell exactly into its own footprint, like the first two buildings did. It was reduced not just to rubble but to dust, but no plane crashed into it. So the whole major theory about plane jet fuels causing a fire which causes buildings to implode on their own footprints can't possibly be true about the third building, because the third building had no plane crashing into it, but it's still disintegrated in exactly the same way as the other two. But most people, I mean, it's only recently that WTC-7 has come to international attention. People like myself and our group have been aware of it all along, but the mainstream media basically ignored it for many years and then started to come out with silly stories about why this building had collapsed, which can't possibly be the same explanation as why the first two buildings collapsed. It just won't hold water. And I'm afraid the story basically is coming apart at the seams after 10 years. There's loads of research been done, and the government basically have not come up with a credible explanation of what happened.
Well, certainly the US military are sticking to their guns. And how would it have been possible to keep something, if it was a conspiracy, a cover-up of some kind? Many, many people would have had to have been involved in it. How on earth would they manage to keep it secret all this time?
Well, first of all, you don't have to have that many people involved. What we know was happening with various exercises were going on the day of planes crashing into buildings. The whole US Air Force apparently was having a war game in northern Canada of a Soviet or Russian aeroplane attack over the North Pole, and that's why all of their aircraft were not actually functional around the east coast of the United States on the day. That's the story. I mean, that's the other major fact that I always point to. Where was the United States Air Force? We've had 10 years now, we've had an investigation, everybody should be able to explain what happened to the United States Air Force. We had four airliners flying around in the most heavily defended airspace in the world. The Pentagon is probably the most heavily defended air point in world air defences, and four planes fly around for an hour and a half without being intercepted once. During the Battle of Britain in the 1940s, how long did it take for the RAF to get airborne once they picked up a radar trace? 5 minutes? 10 minutes? An hour and a half, the United States.
But these are airliners. These are airliners, Martin, and there was no warning of the attack.
It doesn't matter, does it? The radar shows you exactly where these things are. An airliner is bigger than a Messerschmitt. You should be able to find it. And of course, they were telling us that they were seeing these blips on the screen. I mean, they were actually having a war game on the day, I understand, with lots of false blips. So it's because they were pretending to have a war game of planes crashing into buildings. And then, of course, actually some of those planes were real and ended up crashing into buildings. And this is probably, this is speculation, of course, probably how it was done. Now, our position as we investigate 9/11 is we don't actually have theories about what happened. We're not in a position to understand what happened because we're not the police force. We're not. We haven't got the resources. All we do is point out the contradictions in the official narrative, and we demand a full investigation because it's not been properly looked into. And we don't try and speculate too much about what may have happened. I've got my own theories after all the research I've done over 10 years. I've got my own theories, but my theories are not what we're about. We're about pointing out why the official story can't be true and why another investigation may have to happen. And many members of the 9/11 commission resigned. Max Cleland, for example, the Democrat senator, resigned because he said this is a whitewash and I'm having no part of it. So I think we've already got warning signals flashing there, and people should take notice of them.
So, okay, ultimately, why? If it was a cover-up, if there was a conspiracy on September the 11th, then why was the point of it?
Well, I mean, as I say, I don't like to speculate on one level, because all we're pointing out is that the official story can't be true. I have got my own theories about why, and most of the listeners can probably work it out for themselves. It's not rocket science. Most American people, United States citizens, are actually quite nice people. They wouldn't want to go to war with foreign countries to steal their oil, and if somebody said to me, "You're invading foreign countries to steal their oil," they'd be shocked. So, of course, they have to be scared out of their wits. They have to be herded along, and something terrible has to happen to them so that they feel as if they're under attack. And then, of course, they're willing to support the government in its various adventures abroad. And that's pretty clearly what's happened, to be honest. General Ivashov, who was the commander of the Russian armed forces on September the 11th, people can look him up on the internet. Ivashov, Ivashov. He's basically saying quite straightforwardly, our position is this was an inside job, and he was the head of the Russian armed forces. He will have had all access to all Russian intelligence on the day and afterwards. And I suspect that these kind of people know what they're talking about.
And as Mandy Rice Davis might say, he would say that, wouldn't he?
He would.
But anyway, on Monday this week, the occasional BBC Two series, The Conspiracy Files, aired their hour-long look at the 9/11 attacks 10 years on. Now, let's have a listen to one particularly astounding revelation from that film, where we hear about the White House's head of counter-terrorism at the time, Richard Clark. And he explains that back in August 2001, while the intelligence service in the US, the CIA, were on red alert, nobody told him anything.
January 2000. Two terrorists arrive in California from the Far East. Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Mudar were known to be active members of an al-Qaeda cell. But it didn't arouse any suspicions when the smartly dressed young men presented their passports at immigration. Their names had not been added to the watch list for terrorist suspects. Al-Hazmi and Al-Mudar were allowed on their way, unchallenged.
Welcome to Los Angeles International Airport.
They soon moved into a San Diego suburb and lived openly under their real names. They had come on a mission. And this is where they learnt to fly. At about the same time, a CIA cable confirmed that one of them was in the country, but this lead wasn't passed on to the FBI. So, at the time, the local FBI didn't know they were here.
We're just coming up here on the apartments where the two hijackers lived, over here on my left.
One of the terrorists was actually listed in the San Diego phone book.
I think we could have identified some of these potential hijackers before September 11th. It's very frustrating. It's very frustrating to me personally. It's very frustrating to everybody that worked on it so hard here in the FBI in San Diego. I think everybody has to ask themselves, was there something that maybe could have saved 3,000 lives? That's in the forefront of everybody's mind, but it still hurts.
Whilst the two terrorists were learning to fly, intelligence was streaming into the FBI that Al-Qaeda could be planning an attack. By the spring of 2001, the system was blinking red, according to the intelligence chiefs. But there was nothing specific for the FBI to go on.
When I was in the White House, there were lots of conspiracy theories.
We investigated every conspiracy theory.
The former chief counter-terrorism advisor questions whether there was a conspiracy which might have allowed 9/11 to happen.
I still don't have an adequate explanation as to why the CIA, so many people, 60 people in the CIA, knew that Midar and Hamzi were in the United States and didn't tell me and didn't tell the FBI. So I think that's an open book.
At last, 19 days before 9/11, the FBI was finally told. Had the two terrorists in San Diego been arrested, there was a chance that the whole plot could have been prized open. But they had long moved on and disappeared.
Anyway, that was an extract from the BBC Two conspiracy files aired, transmitted on Monday evening this week. Martin, why didn't the CIA tell the FBI? Because one would have thought that was the obvious thing to do if they thought there was a terror attack in the offing.
Well, I think what we've got there is primary evidence from people, and we've got to, you know, obviously take it with a pinch of salt one way or the other. My own first warnings about 9/11 came on the day of the attack when I got on the internet, and I discovered that John O'Neill, who was the deputy director of the FBI, had resigned in July 2001 and given a press conference in France with two French journalists saying, "I was in charge of trying to catch bin Laden, but every time I got anywhere near him, I was told to back off by the Bush administration. I'm fed up with it and I'm resigning." And that was my first indication that something was amiss, although I suspected a rat immediately. What John O'Neill was saying was that the US embassy in Saudi Arabia was issuing visas to known terrorists to allow them to come into the United States, because that was, you know, basically he was saying, I was absolutely frustrated. These people I knew were terrorists were being given visas by the embassy, and he went down to Saudi Arabia and had a row with them and saying, "Why are you doing this?" And what we've probably got, I'm just guessing, this is what an inquiry should look into, is a group within the CIA who have basically got their own agenda. Don't forget, Al-Qaeda was set up by the CIA and MI6. There's no doubt about that. That's the historical record. The story we're being told is that they set up Al-Qaeda to go and fight in Afghanistan, but suddenly these guys all went rogue like Frankenstein's monster and charged all over the place and they didn't know what they were up to. Frankly, I don't believe that. The World Trade Center attack in 1993, if people remember that, it was shown that that was a sting operation by the FBI. The terrorists brought in a bomb. They were given the explosives by the FBI in New York. They'd all got visas in Egypt to come to the US, even though they were known terrorists. And they blew up the bomb, killed six people, and then they were all immediately arrested because the FBI had run the whole operation. And their lead informant in the operation said, "Well, presumably you've given me dud explosives." And they said, no, "We've given you real explosives." They said, "So you actually want me to blow things up?" And they said, "Yes, blow it up, and then we'll arrest all these guys." And most of the people who've been arrested in the United States since 9/11 for terrorist offences have all been sting operations, where the FBI has set up the terrorist cell, recruited people to it, basically entrapped them, and then sprung the trap and said, "Oh, look, these people are terrorists." But every single one of those cases has been an FBI sting operation. Now, where do sting operations end and collusion with terrorism begin? Ask the British Army's Force Research Unit that used to run the Loyalist paramilitary campaign in Northern Ireland. You know, this is how the real world works. What you do is you create the enemy that you want to fight, you manipulate them, and what you're actually doing is manipulating public opinion.
Now, one of the most important eyewitnesses to the attacks was World Trade Center janitor William Rodriguez. William didn't appear in the Conspiracy Files program. When the plane hit his tower, rather than running away, he ran up the stairs to open fire doors, which he knew were closed, to allow people to escape to safety. I spoke to William back in 2005 when he visited Bristol to give a presentation at the old IMAX cinema at Bristol.
I am William Rodriguez. I am the last survivor pulled from the rubble from the North Tower, last person to come out of the North Tower, and I worked in the building for almost 20 years. I was the person in charge of all the stairwells of the North Tower. I have the only master key that was used on 9/11, and became after that the leader of all the victim survivors of New York, and organize and advocate for changes from then on for victims of terrorism.
So tell me, why was the master key so important?
The master key was very important because there were only five master keys available in the whole complex. And on that day, the people with the other four master keys were trained for egress and escape techniques and first aid techniques were the first ones to run out. So I found myself in the difficult situation of deciding what to do. And using the master key was crucial at that moment to save hundreds of lives. Otherwise, they will be probably stuck at that moment in different offices without knowing how to get out. So that was the importance of that key.
Can you just take us briefly through your day as it started normally? What time?
My day started usually at 8 o'clock. I come in. We have a punching clock for the time card. The office was located at the basement of building one, I'm sorry, the North Tower. The building has 6 sub-levels, and those sub-levels were located between B1 and B6 for the support of the whole complex, like the Department of Painting, the Department of Structural Design, everything that had to do with engineering and support and maintenance of the complex was located on those floors.
But it was very different on this day, wasn't it? You arrived at 8 o'clock as normal, but what happened?
I came in late. I called that I was going to be a little late and got there at 8:30. I started talking to the supervisor. We were actually exchanging information about... I just came back from a vacation from Puerto Rico, and he wanted to know everything about Puerto Rico. So we were chit-chatting. And 8:46, we heard an explosion, and it was coming from the lower levels. And as I thought at that moment, it was that it was an electrical generator that blew up at that moment. I was going to say, listen, I think it's an electrical generator. And at that very moment, the impact on the top. We hear an impact at the top of the building.
How can you be so certain of the time?
Very simple. We were right next to the time clock. We were right there. The time clock, remember, I just have to punch in, and we were right there.
But what you've said is very strange for most people, that there was an explosion from the bottom of the World Trade Center before the impact of the aircraft.
Yeah, and I will have enough experience to know if it was coming from the top or coming from the bottom. Again, for being in the building for so many years, the experience alone will give you at least a sense of where the noises are coming from in the building.
So what happened then after the plane hit the top? How did the building shake?
The building shake, and all the false ceiling completely collapsed. The walls cracked. The sprinkler system got activated. We had an explosion after that, and a person coming into the office running, saying "explosion, explosion, explosion," with his hands extended. And when I look at his hands, I saw something hanging from the top of the fingertips, and I did not know what it was. And when I looked at it, I realized it was his skin was pulled from under his armpits all the way to the top of the fingertips. Imagine you take off a glove and you let it hanging. That's exactly how he looked at the moment. And then when I look at his face, I saw missing parts of his face by the ear side and on the right side. And I said, "What happened? What happened?" And he said, "The elevators, the lifts." And at that moment, I just couldn't understand why was he saying the elevators. Apparently, he was in front of the elevators. And on the elevator shaft, there was fire. And the vapor pulled his skin out of his arms, just like that. And the guy was in shock. And I said, "Everybody out, everybody out." And the building was oscillating so hard that you could feel the floor moving under you. I pushed everybody out from the office. There were 14 people. And the guy that was burned, he was a black guy named Felipe David. I put his arm around my shoulder, and I took it out of the building. I led everybody out through the loading dock that faced the Vestry area, which is towards the north side. And when I got out, there was an ambulance coming, running like crazy. And I stopped the ambulance, put the guy inside the ambulance, and... that's when I heard that a plane hit the building on a security guard's radio. When I turned around, that's when I saw the hole, I saw the debris coming down, I saw the fire, but I couldn't see the antenna of the building.
Okay, most people don't know about explosions, but it sounds to me, particularly having one explosion before the plane hit and also this possible explosion of your friend, about explosives in the building.
Mr. Felipe David, the guy that was burned, was reunited with me like 3.5 months after, because he saw me on TV talking about problems with the families and the survivors. And he called the doctors and said, that's the guy that saved me. And the doctor called the news media, and the news media made the reunion with him, actually, for the cameras. And it was very emotional and it was a catharsis.
So what about these explosions? Most people haven't heard of explosions. What do you put it down to? And, you know, what did you see on the day?
Well, there were explosions, and actually when I was pulled from the rubble the same day, I spoke about it on CNN and on national news, and I wasn't the only person that talked about that. Other news reporters that were in the area were talking about it, and all of a sudden the whole new item of what was happening on that day fizzled out or was actually changed as events were unfolding. But I don't understand why people all of a sudden tried to forget those initial interviews, which were crucial. And actually, we testified for the 9/11 Commission, and that testimony didn't show up on the final report. So we are very... amazed and at the same time discouraged that most of the information that were available on that day were not taken in consideration.
So you have one of the main master keys and you went up to open up doors. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, when I came back running inside the building because I saw the hole and I saw the fire, I started screaming to everybody that we have to go back because of the people on Windows of the World. That was the restaurant that was located on top of the building. And nobody wanted to go back in. And I said, we got to go back in. We got to go back in. And so I took it upon myself of going back by myself through the basement. And there I found two guys, a guy from the janitorial department named Jimmy Barrett, and a lady called Maureen, which is, she was in charge of the security for the Marriott Hotel, which was half destroyed too after that. And they didn't know what was happening. So I told them that they have to get out because we had an emergency in the building. They didn't even know that the building was hit by a plane because they were located on the other building. For that, I ran back to building one, on the basement, all of this on the basement, found a recycling guy that told me there were two people talking in an elevator, and I put my ear in one of the elevators, and effectively there were two people screaming that they were going to drown. I couldn't understand why will they drown? And apparently was that all the water from the sprinkler system from the whole complex was going down the elevator shaft, and they got encapsulated between B2 and B3. Now, it's really deep if you think about it. And so I said, God, please give me a hand. What can I do? What can I do? And I found a pipe in the area, and I took that metal and opened the doors, but it was empty. There was, you know, an empty hollow area there because there was no elevator. So all the water on my side, once the door opened, went rushing in with more force, so the screaming was louder. And at that moment, I said the same thing. God help me. I need to find something, how to help these people. And at that very moment, I remember that the electricians, they have ladders that they use to change light bulbs and things like that. And they always located them in front of the garbage compactors, but they tie them up with chains because people usually stole them because they will go on the loading dock, put them in the truck, and take them out. So they were always tied up with chains. And I was just hoping to find only one on chain. And the miracle was that the only one that was on chain was the longest of all of them. It was an 18 feet long ladder. And I took it, dropped it in, went inside, opened the latch, got both people out. One of them is Salvatore Giambanco, a painter. The other one was a delivery guy. Brought them outside, put them in an ambulance, and went back running inside the building. They did survive, too. And they did the reunion again for television months after. And I tell you this because it's incredible that when I came out and say the story once I was pulled from the rubble, a lot of people said, oh, this guy is Superman. They didn't even believe it. And all of a sudden, people started coming out and validating the story. And those same people that actually were criticizing, all of a sudden, they did the push to make me a national figure in the United States.
Can you explain, though, about your master key? Why was this so important?
The master key was very important for the simple reason that the building was a Class A building. A Class A building meaning that it was a skyscraper over 50 floors up. They have to encapsulate fires on the floors in a matter of an emergency. That meant that three doors will not open on the stairwells, and one will open for escape. Three won't open, one will open, all the way up to 110th floor. So that key was crucial, because with that key, those floors that didn't open will open with that key.
Right, so there would be many people who were trying to get into the stairwells and down who couldn't.
Correct. If you went from a re-entry door down to another floor, you wouldn't be able to. But if you were in those offices and you tried to get out, yes, you could. But the problem was that the World Trade Center has 70,000 people working there, and the turnaround was so huge that a lot of people did not know where the exits were, and they only have drills twice a year. And later on our advocacy, we made them change the law, and at the same time, we are asking requirements that any buildings over a certain amount of floor will have mandatory training for new employees.
Well, that was William Rodriguez, janitor at the World Trade Center, on September the 11th, 2001, speaking to me back in 2005. Martin, just briefly, the 9/11 Commission report, William gave a full report to them, but they didn't use any of his testimony whatever in the final published version of the report. I mean, what do you put that down to?
It's a cover-up. It's a whitewash. It's quite simple, really. You said briefly, whitewash.
Well, the obvious thing, though, is that the 9/11 Commission thought that he wasn't a credible witness.
Well, I think the listeners can make their own judgment about that. Frankly, they originally bigged William up as a great hero, which he was on the day. He saved hundreds of lives.
That's right. There were film going around the world of him with George W. Bush.
There's a picture of him shaking hands with George Bush, because he was one of the heroes of the day. But when he started saying what he saw and knew what had happened on the day, he was immediately turned into persona non grata. And, of course, we've had him over here in Britain, and we took him round, and he did a gig for us in the IMAX cinema in Bristol. And... I think people need to hear his testimony.
And you're listening to Friday Drive Time on BCFM 93.2, and the Politics Show with Martin Summers and Tony Gosling. Today we're going through some of the facts that have come out since 9/11, which are very little known about as we come up to the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. Politics, reason it's important is because it's affected so much of politics over the last 10 years, as we've heard earlier on. Now, Scott Forbes was an English chap who worked in New York's World Trade Center at the time of the 9/11 attacks, and lost 89 of his work colleagues in those attacks. From his nearby flat on his day off on Manhattan, Scott witnessed the second plane strike the tower just below the offices where his colleagues were working, whilst being on the phone to them. Here is his eyewitness account of the security system's power down and mysterious cabling contractors working in the building all through the weekend immediately preceding the attacks.
My name's Scott Forbes. I worked and still work for a financial institution who were housed in the World Trade Center, Tower 2, South Tower. We were on floors 90 and 94 to 97 on the South Tower, and consequently the company I worked for lost a lot of people on that day. We lost 89 employees, plus a number of other contract staff who worked on our floors.
You weren't there on the day. How did you manage to escape what happened on September the 11th?
I had the day off work, a day off in lieu, as I'd worked the previous weekend. That was Saturday the 8th, Sunday the 9th. Occasionally, working in technology, occasionally I was asked to work weekends, and so we would have a day off in lieu for that effort. And so my day off was on Tuesday the 11th, which is why I was not there. The reason I was working on the 8th and 9th was because of a power down condition in the South Tower. We were given approximately 3 weeks notice by the Port Authority that there would be no power in the top half of the tower. And as our data center was on the 97th floor, and this was for a global institution, it meant we had to switch off all our systems. In the time I'd been in the company, we'd not gone through that operation before, and we certainly didn't plan for that operation. So to go through the process of shutting down all of our systems one by one was an enormous exercise, taking many hours. It wasn't a question of just turning off a switch. We had to shut down applications, we had to shut down networks, physically shut down servers, shut down databases, which is the work I do. So the operation involved was pretty massive and the planning involved was very rigorous. And it wasn't just myself working that weekend, there were many others, probably about 30 people working that weekend on the shutdown exercise. And after the work, so-called work, was completed, the restart of all the systems. And in fact, we didn't finish on the weekend. On the Monday evening, the 10th, we still had some systems not fully operational.
So what days were the actual power down happening and what reason was given?
The reason that was given was that there was a recabling exercise. It was as general as that. The days of the power down were Saturday the 8th and Sunday the 9th of September. The shutdown started around noon on Saturday the 8th, and we were bringing up the systems from around 2, 3pm on Sunday the 9th. So the period was about 24 hours.
So how did that whole operation go from your company's point of view? Was it all successful? Did you manage to bring everything down and then the power went down and then you brought everything up fine afterwards?
Apart from these one or two systems that we were having issues with, everything else went fairly smoothly. On the Monday evening, I was in the office till around 7 that night with several other people trying to sort out the systems that we're having issues with on the Monday night. But apart from those, the shutdown and the startup went like clockwork, fairly standard, you know, didn't make us think too much. It was just unusual to have the power down and to have no power. And just to point out one thing, we had a generator in the data center, part of our legal compliance, being a financial institution in the state of New York, was that we had to have a backup power supply, but it was considered whether we could live on that without having to shut down, and it was decided no, we shouldn't, that for safety we should shut everything down.
Isn't that sort of thing quite normal? You would have to be prepared for a power cut, surely?
If there was a power cut, the generator would kick in normal circumstances, and I don't know the full details, but I think the generator was equipped to last probably about 12 hours, which would deal with most power cut conditions. So if there was a shock power cut, sure, the generator would kick in, no systems would go down. As the power was being removed from the building and there was a recabling exercise going on, we considered it a little bit more dangerous and unusual, and therefore we decided to shut everything down just in case the period did extend longer than a 12-hour period.
Now, if there are recabling exercises going on, you would expect, you would expect there to be quite a lot of activity in the building, or the people doing the recabling.
When I was there, I did see people from outside agencies. We didn't pay special attention to these guys. We just thought they were engineers or builders or maintenance staff. There were people around, but we didn't pay any particular attention to them. All I can say is that there was unusual activity. There were men in uniforms, like overalls, carrying toolboxes, and there was lots of cabling around and so on. But, you know, at the time we didn't pay special attention to them, frankly.
So there was obviously something actually going on where there was workmen that wouldn't normally be there. Maybe you could just take us through, describe people that you saw.
Sure. Going into the towers from the ground floor, employees had security badges in order to pass through gates to reach the elevators. Once you were in the elevator, it was just push button. To gain access into our offices, we then had a separate security badge to gain access into our offices. So all of that was in operation going in on the Saturday to do the power down. From the ground floor, it was clear that there was activity, there were people around beyond the normal. The ground floor elevator took us to the lobby at 78, and on the 78th floor lobby, again, there was unusual activity. There were people around and cabling and boxes, toolboxes. Then from there, I took the elevator up to the 97th floor, and I didn't see any activity on our floor, frankly. I remember it on the lobby areas.
Okay, so can you just describe these people? What did they look like? I mean, did they have any sort of like big company logo or anything like that on their jackets as they're working?
I can't remember specific details about individuals. You know, I can't describe you individual guys. And I can't remember any logos at all. I've been asked whether I saw any vehicles outside. I can't remember seeing any vehicles. I just remember guys in like blue and grey overalls, like workmen. That's all I can describe.
And roughly how many? Have you any idea? I mean, you probably have only seen a few at the bottom and in the lobbies, but you know, roughly how many people did you see?
I would have said three or four down in the ground floor lobby, three or four on the 78th floor lobby as well.
So there was definitely activity going on. Your own experience being in New York, actually on September the 11th, how did you, I mean, you must imagine you know, it was a bigger surprise to you as everybody else that day to realise, well, crikey, I could have been in there.
I lived in an apartment facing the Trade Center in Jersey City, so I had an unobstructed view of the towers across the Hudson River. I lived three streets from the riverfront. So I saw everything going on that day. I didn't see the first plane to hit. It was so bright, my blinds were closed, but I heard the noise and I went to the window and looked through the blinds and saw smoke from the North Tower. Focusing in on the smoke, it seemed very odd, and initially I thought it was an explosion at the Windows on the World restaurant. But it just looked very odd, and anything happening to the towers and working in technology, I knew there would be an impact to us. So my first response was to call my office, and I called the first number I could think of, which was my colleague. He sat next to me, and he answered the phone immediately on speakerphone because he recognized my number, and his first words to me were, "Scott, what was that?" They'd heard it in the South Tower. And I said, "I don't know if it was an explosion, but I see smoke and flames coming out from the North Tower. I don't know if it's Windows on the World, but something's going on and probably you're going to get evacuated." And he said, "Okay, I'm going now. I'm going to see what's going on." And my instinct said to him, "Mark, just leave the building. I don't like the feel about this." And he says, "Yeah, I'm going." And he cut me off. I called him back instantly because I knew he wouldn't leave. And he shouted at me, What's the matter? And I said, "Mark, just leave. Don't put your shoes on. Just walk out the building." I said, "Okay, I'm going. And before he could sign off, another colleague overheard me. And he shouted across the office, "Scott, was it a plane?" And I said, "I don't know. Hold on." And I turned on the TV. And coincidentally, TV coverage, as I turned on the TV, went to a live shot looking from the north down to the tower. So I was then seeing it from a different angle. So on TV, I was looking from the north, and from my apartment, I was looking from the west. So I was seeing it from two angles. And on the TV, they reported it was a plane. So I said, "Brian, they say it was a plane." And he said, "A small jet, like a two-seater, or a big plane?" And I'm seeing this big hole in the towers. And I said, "Brian, I think it was a f-ing great big plane." And they then cut me off. Brian didn't make it out the towers. Mark did.
Do you think there was a sort of panic and chaos going on in your offices?
I wouldn't describe it as panic. From what I understand, talking to everybody after the event, management were ushering the staff out of the building to follow emergency procedures. Emergency procedures were to go down the stairs. My colleague Mark didn't follow the emergency procedures. He used the elevator, and he was lucky he got out. Other people who used the stairs did not. Piecing together the impressions and the puzzle of what was going on, it seemed like management were ushering staff out of the building as effectively as they could, using the emergency procedures. So the majority of staff were leaving through the stairwells. Some staff left by elevator. One of my colleagues was one, and he escaped. Other people who either went by elevator or by stairwell didn't get out because they weren't quick enough. Some people managed to get out very fortunately. Some people didn't. And, you know, in some cases, we don't know what happened to these people. One of my colleagues left with another. She stopped to take off her shoes so she could run. And her colleague ran ahead. She got out. He didn't. So, you know, there were very unusual things going on. Those people who were lost, by people remembering where they were, we were able to identify what they were doing in some cases. So a couple of colleagues were actually just looking through the window. They didn't leave the building. They were looking at the other tower. They just didn't leave. Whereas other people must have been on their way out, but somehow didn't get out. Either they decided to stop and make a phone call, or they came out of the stairwell on a floor to try and take an elevator, and the delay caused them to be still in the building when the building collapsed. So, you know, the stories are very, very mixed up.
You had the phone put down on you, or you put the phone down. Did the second plane impact on, and how close was it to the offices?
It was about 8 or 10 minutes after I put the phone down on my colleagues in the building. I was still on the phone actually to other people, to other colleagues. I had another colleague who didn't work on that Tuesday as well. He took the day off too, and I called him for some passwords to log into systems remotely. I couldn't do it from home, so I couldn't make access. So I phoned one of my colleagues here in London, and she was able to connect to the systems, and I gave her the passwords to shut them down. We knew there was going to be a disaster recovery invoked, and therefore we were shutting everything down in preparation for that. And subsequently, she was able to remain connected to systems until the building collapsed. At the moment it collapsed is when she lost connectivity, which is kind of interesting. So I was on the phone constantly, and in fact I was on the phone with her when I saw the second plane coming. I saw it coming from my right, coming over New Jersey and over Staten Island, way off in the distance and quite high. And my brain told me this was like either a rescue mission or it was a plane full of water. And I wasn't worried about the plane coming in until the very last moment. I stopped speaking. I was on the a voicemail message to my colleague here, and I stopped speaking perhaps a second and a half, 2 seconds before the plane hit. When the noise of the plane changed distinctly, its angle changed, and it was clear it was going to hit the building. So it hit the building from the west, so it was parallel to me. The explosion went out to the east, so I didn't see much of the explosion. All I saw was the plane go into the building. So my vision of the explosion was on TV rather than from my visual. Disbelief.
And was it quite close to where your offices were?
It was underneath our offices. It appeared, and subsequently I've seen the videos, but it appeared to me then too, it was slightly above the 78th lobby, perhaps 80, 82, something like that. So above the lobby, below our offices, probably the worst place for the escaping staff from our offices.
This whole thing with the power down, getting back to that, and the Port Authority, how abnormal and how unusual was that?
I'd never come across it, and I'd worked in the towers since 98. Other colleagues of mine who'd been there in 93 when there was the bombing recall similar conditions then. When the bombing happened, the power went out. Apparently, there were power downs in the towers, either totally or partially. I had never been involved in an exercise where we'd shut down systems. So there may have been power downs where, in our case, the generator was used to maintain supplies. But in terms of shutting down our systems, this was the first time that I'd been across it. And we had no, like, documentary procedure to do it. It was something we had to work on quickly.
And what about, because those events of that day have led to what is this called a war on terror, which is has really changed much of what we have come to expect around the world. There's this kind of terrorists popping up in all sorts of different countries, North Korea possibly, and other places. What is your feeling from September the 11th about that subsequent change in sort of international relations, the war on terror itself?
Well, I've got very personal opinions on that. I don't tie my personal beliefs, my political beliefs, to what I saw and witnessed on 9/11 and the weekend before, so I don't associate them. I try not to associate them. For me, I'll answer in two ways. For me, the importance of getting the question of why, confirmation that there was the power down from the authorities and acknowledgement from the authorities that it did occur and an explanation for it, for me that is a mission in itself.
Have you found that difficult then?
Very, very difficult. The 9/11 Commission didn't register it. I contacted them by email, through their website, by phone, and they've made no effort to mention it in their findings and their eventual document. I've contacted the Port Authority many times, and mostly they refuse to acknowledge me. They now deny that the power down occurred, but I know it occurred, and my colleagues know it occurred. So this is why, for me, to get it acknowledged and explained is a mission. It's a mission for me because I lost so many friends and colleagues, and I just need it explained. And it's worrying to me that this issue is not is not contained in any explanation of the events. If you're carrying out a forensics analysis of what went on 9/11, this has to be included. As when I saw the South Tower collapse, and to me, I describe it as collapsing like sand. That's how it looked to me. My gut instinct then was to say, what did we do at the weekend?
That was Scott Forbes there speaking to me back in 2005, just next to Charing Cross Station, as it happens, where he's working now in London. And Scott witnessed the attacks very much from his flat. And the reason he wasn't at work that day is because he'd been in the World Trade Center making sure that all the computers in his company were shut down because there'd been a power down. Now, Martin, what do you think, listening to Scott there? He's someone like William who's saying that even though he's given evidence to the 9/11 Commission report whilst it was active back in 2002, nothing was printed in their final report from him, and in fact he wasn't even acknowledged by the Port Authority.
Well, I think it's interesting that he's saying they deny that there was a power down. I mean, why would you deny that there was a power down? I mean, that's extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, we know from I know from speaking to William that what was very interesting is that the World Trade Center was actually owned by the New York Port Authority until some weeks before the attack, when it was actually privatised and bought by a consortium of businessmen led by one Larry Silverstein. And basically they insured the buildings against terrorist attack and cleaned up on the insurance.
Now, were you saying a couple of weeks ago that Rupert Murdoch was also involved in that consortium?
Well, I understand that he was part of that consortium. That doesn't mean anything. I mean, you can be part of a consortium without knowing what the consortium gets up to. But what William was saying is that because he'd worked in the World Trade Center for 20 years, he knew pretty much, you know, most of the people he would see around the building. But he said because of the privatization, whole lots of new people came in to do all sorts of things that he'd never seen before. And if we're looking for a modus operandi for planting explosives in the building, because of course that is the allegation, that would possibly explain it. And of course we've had Professors Nils Harrit from Copenhagen University and Steve Jones of the University of Utah, who have definitely proved, and it's all been peer-reviewed in the chemistry journals, that the nanothermite was found in the rubble, nanothermite being an extremely high-grade explosive used by the US military.
Now, this was something which was dealt with very much by the BBC Conspiracy Files programme on Monday. Mm-hmm. They had Nils Harrit talking about this, saying he put a paper together, and then they also let a bunch of American scientists, and they said basically, look, this paper by Nils Harrit was such a load of rubbish that we didn't even bother to peer review it.
Well, that's just not true. I mean, basically, the paper by Harrit and Jones has been peer-reviewed by the academic journals. And if you remember that Popular Mechanics popularised the theory of the pancake collapse of the floors, Popular Mechanics is a trade magazine that sells garden sheds and lawnmowers. It's not a journal of repute. But the Harrit and Jones have put their findings about nanothermite through rigorous academic testing, and you can always find somebody who's prepared to say, oh, I think it's rubbish, but I'm afraid the peer review is there to make sure that that can't be said. I mean, they did peer review it. It took them years to get it through the journals, but it was all published and peer reviewed.
And I must apologise also for the swearing in the report from Scott Forbes there. Well, you could say it was a reportage explaining exactly what the conversation was going on between him and his office as the second plane hit the South Tower.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Well, on to our news review now, and the Lib Dems are planning a tax raid on landowners, we hear this week. The Liberal Democrats are planning a new land tax, which will clobber Middle Britain. At least this is what the Daily Express is saying. Controversial proposals will see millions of pounds stripped from people up and down the country, aimed at wealthy landowners, property magnates and foreign millionaires, but is also likely to hit middle-class householders who have a few acres of land. Now, Martin, you've talked about land tax quite a lot on here.
Yep. I think this is a potentially good idea. I don't suppose the Conservatives will be very happy to hear the Liberals talking like this, but Andy Burnham, the Labour candidate for leader of the Labour Party, also suggested that one of the things we need to think about is a land value taxation system. And of course, that's the way to get the money off wealthy people. They can squirrel away their liquid money in accounts in Switzerland, but they can't make property move. So when I was an advisor in the Eastern Bloc, after it was the Eastern Bloc, I was talking to various people in Moscow about this, and they were saying, well, that's the only way we can get the money off the oligarchy, is by basically taxing property, because property can't run away. It's a good idea.
The crucial thing here, of course, though, is what kind of threshold? Is it? Do you have to have 1 acre, 2 acres, or 2,000 acres?
It doesn't matter. All land will be taxed proportionate to the amount that you hold. And therefore, if you don't hold very much land, you won't be bothered. And if you hold loads, you'll have to pay a load of money. There you go.
Well, land taxes are to be discussed at the Lib Dem conference next month as the party devises policy for the second phase of the coalition. And Facing the Future, a document by Mr Clegg's aide Norman Lamb, another senior Lib Dem, states, we need to further develop our thinking, looking at wealth taxes, land taxes, green taxes and localisation of revenue raising. Party sources say buy-to-let landlords and landowners such as the Duke of Westminster could be hard hit. Now, what about this idea of hitting buy-to-let landlords? Because they're quite an important part of the
economy. Well, no, they're actually a rather flaky part of the economy, which causes all kinds of problems. I mean, basically, the beauty of land value taxation is when you buy a property, it rises in value. What it will do is it mean that all of that value will, during a bubble, all of that value will be recouped by society to be spent on things that we want to spend things on. And of course, if you've got land value taxation, you might be able to reduce things like income tax or VAT. So poorer people can be given a hand up. Basically, the Duke of Westminster gets paid a lot of money every year for doing nothing. He's just the biggest landowner in the country, so he's got an income stream coming into him.
Well, didn't his ancestors fight somebody?
Yes,
for
they
that
did. Well, they came over with Duke William and they took the land, but basically it's our land and we should have the revenue from it, not individuals like the Duke of Westminster.
But Martin,
he doesn't perform any useful social function.
It's not our land, it's the Duke of Westminster's land.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, ultimately, the value of land depends upon the activities of others. So the value of a piece of property that you own rises as the economy rises. So you just have to sit there, other people are being entrepreneurial, other people are creating new businesses, other people are working as cleaners or whatever, they're creating value, but people who have land basically just take a cut for doing nothing. The economist Ricardo pointed this out in the 19th century. And the obvious way to fund social expenditures is to capture that economic rent, that income stream, for doing nothing.
This is something
and that should go to everybody, not just to individuals.
This is something that Winston Churchill talked about at the end of the Second World
Indeed,
War.
Indeed, it's been talked about by lots
of
people.
So it's not new to the Conservatives.
No, it's not. It's not. And it's actually, I'm glad to see the Liberals bringing this up, because we need to have an adult discussion about how we're going to reboot the taxation system in this country so that we can have the resources we need to break the back of the depression that we're going into. And the only way to do that is to find some way of getting wealth from the hands of the super wealthy into the hands of everybody else. And this is a scam by the super wealthy. They buy land and it just rises in value and they just get an income stream from it for doing nothing. That income stream will inevitably fall, should fall to us. I mean, basically what you ultimately could end up with is land nationalisation, which was recommended by Henry George.
Well, it was also talked about
century.
At the end of the Second World War. Lots of things were nationalised.
Yes.
They were talking about nationalising land.
Yes.
They decided instead to bring in the Town and Country Planning Act, the planning system, to regulate development on land.
Yes.
Instead of,
I mean, but basically we, like lots of things we should have done, we didn't do it. Maybe we should do it now.
That's coming up now to Sky News at 6. After the news, we're joined by a local historian and a local businessman to get a health check on our city's economy and the health of our democracy.
Your voice, and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody...